Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two perfect sponsors this week. Media Temple, web hosting. Excellent company. We have coupon code SHOPTALK. Gets you 25% off your first month. We'll tell you more about that later in the show. And Environments for Humans, who are promoting their Artifact Conference. So go to artifactconf.com to learn all about that. We'll tell you what's going on with that later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off. Hello and welcome to episode 100 of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design, development, sound effects, all the things you love. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. And it seems like, so this episode has some weight. It's episode 100. That's pretty good, right?
100.
There's got to be a sound effect for that of some kind. That's pretty good.
Chris. Great job. Good job.
Thanks. We don't have any big fireworks for you other than we made it. That's pretty cool. Maybe we'll do a big party later on, but that's all right.
Anyone can get to 100, but getting to 123, that's 123.
We'll plan
that's
the big
tough.
Party for 123. But with us, we have Rachel Andrew. Hey, Rachel.
Hello.
Hey. Again, that's a cause for celebration.
Yeah, so from the UK, yeah?
Yeah.
Maidenhead. Where is that?
No, not anymore. I'm now in Bristol. I was in Maidenhead.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we've
Bristol,
just moved to
okay. Bristol.
Yeah. Maidenhead is kind of underneath the Heathrow flight path. So if you've flown into Heathrow, you're kind of where the wheels of the plane come down. That was kind of where I lived. But now we're down in Bristol, which is sort of the west of the country.
Okay. Yeah, you were just saying you moved. So essentially, after you get the internet back and you're settled in, you have to do a big find replace on rachelandrew.co.uk.
Yes, exactly. There's all sorts of places I need to change addresses. It's very boring.
Not the best work. So let's figure out about you. You have so much that you do. That's why I'm so glad that you're on the show with us today, because I feel like you have stuff to say about the business of our industry and the culture of it. And not to mention, of course, just being good at the design and development and all of the deep nuts and bolts of our industry as well. So what's like the most of the time that you spend to do? Maybe we should start with that. Like, is there a thing that takes up a primary amount of your time?
Well, these days I'm very much involved on sort of the business side of what we do with Perch, which is our product. So I spend more of my time these days doing, I guess, business things rather than actual development. And I also do quite a lot of sort of systems stuff, so operations things as well. So I do more of that now than I actually do sort of building websites, so which is what I used to do.
But you make a thing that helps other people build websites, right?
Yes.
That's what Perch is.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we about a year ago, we went full time on Perch. So before that, we were a development agency, really, doing client work and things. And sort of over about 4 years, we've moved from doing that to just focusing on the product. So it's kind of it's quite a change.
Nice. Was it a big... Yeah, and was it like a leap of faith, or was it like an easy, obvious, natural transition?
It was just kind of transition, really. I mean, we started, it was a side project when we started it that we worked on in our kind of spare time, as it were. And sort of over 4 years, it's sort of taken up more and more of our time. And because it's become more profitable, we've been able to put more time into it. And it kind of got to a point where if we were doing client work, we were thinking, we'd just rather be working on our product, you know. And so it kind of got to a point where we needed to say, right, that's it. We're not taking on any more projects.
Yeah. So many people have kind of gone through that. And so now, I guess now that you just have more time, I guess, to dedicate into it because you've said no to all those things. And then you replaced that time with what? Like kind of marketing it and better support possibly and writing about it?
Yeah. I mean, it takes up a fair, I mean, just supporting something like Perch takes up a fair amount of time. It's, it's something that people install on their own hosting. So we have lots of support that's actually nothing to do with us, and there's nothing we can do about the fact that PHP web hosting is terrible. So, you know, so we have a huge amount of support. Just, you know, whatever we do is always going to happen as people, you know, try and install things on servers that aren't great and try and get local development environments set up and things like that. So, yeah, we do quite a lot of support.
I imagine the support is crazy.
It's, yeah.
I mean just as far as who knows what you're running into. I'm sure you've come up with kind of interesting, innovative ways for you to figure that out. Or maybe you've read so many emails that you just kind of know what they mean when.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that are just, that are just common to several hosts. You know, there's certain things that tend to be misconfigured and we're used to spotting them now. But yeah, I mean, it's supporting something that people are running in all sorts of environments is tricky.
Yeah. And you're, you know, by most regards, a small team, right? So you sell Perch, the CMS, for $79 per site to use, and because you just have to, because that's how businesses are profitable, and that's what allows you to do the support at all and that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. I just was I like the idea of that it's a business and you charge money to use it. And you write about these kind of things. You have a newsletter that the business of digital products that where you are constantly writing about this type of thing.
Yeah, well, and I find business interesting, you know, just sort of how we do business and how we do business on the web. I find it generally quite interesting. And I kind of like to be we're a business, you know, we're not funded, we don't have investment or anything like that. You know, we're just kind of like a standard business, really. We make a thing and we sell it and we, you know, make enough money to support it and things. Well, I think, you know, there's this kind of, and there's quite a nice community of people who are, you know, what we call sort of bootstrapping, which to me is just like normal business.
So you avoid the word startup is the point.
Yeah. I think, you know, that there's an awful lot of stuff that's written online, which is about startups, as it were. And it's not relevant to people running businesses like ours, you know, where we don't have a huge amount of money to fling at marketing and, you know, buying traffic, essentially buying customers. You know, we don't have that in the sort of self-funded company world. So a lot of it isn't really relevant. And so I like to collect stuff and sort of, you know, share that with other people and say, well, here's some stuff that's actually for businesses like ours that are just making a thing and selling it.
Right. Right. Good support, I'm sure, is, you know, marketing in its own regard and things like that, right? Things that you have to do anyway, but if you do a good job, end up being marketing.
Yeah.
Cool. How would somebody sign up for the business of digital products? Is it
On my website, there's a form in the footer of the website, rachelange.co.uk.
Oh, cool. All right. Yeah. So Let's see. What else do we got here? Just an incredible, if you've never heard of Rachel, you should have, because look at rachelandrew.co.uk/books. There's like 15 books.
Yeah. I kind of can't help it, you know.
Do you just write a book before you go to bed every night? Is that I'll just write ASP web development with Macromedia Dreamweaver MX 2004.
Yeah.
Jam that out.
Yeah. I can't really have a thought without kind of turning it into 1,000 words, you know, so it's.
Cool. So a lot of this stuff will come up. You got to ask it looking at this page. Do you still work in Dreamweaver?
Not for a long time.
Really?
That was kind of how it all started, because I used to just help out on the it was Macromedia back then. We used to sort of answer questions on the Dreamweaver forums, and it was really via that I started writing for publishers, because someone sort of spotted some stuff I'd written and said, "Oh, would you write a bit of a book?" You know, and that's really where all that came from.
Yeah, cool. But it's a different world now.
Yeah,
it looks like none of these were all of these were pre Adobe.
Yes. Yeah. We're quite involved with the Web Standards Project. Drew McClellan and myself sort of were brought in to kind of form the Dreamweaver Task Force, sort of way back when, to try and encourage Macromedia to support standards within Dreamweaver. So we did quite a bit of work with them, sort of pre Adobe, to sort of get some sort of standards compliance within Dreamweaver.
Yeah, cool. And you and Drew are Perch and 24 Ways as well, right? I don't know.
That's Drew's thing, that. Really.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, if you've heard of any of those things, they're related in some way. So we have some, what do you think? Do you want to get into some industry news slash?
Yeah. What a week for drama. This week, we've got three chunks of juicy, juicy drama. So let's start from the top. A List Apart, no stranger to drama. I'm just kidding. Dip their toe. CSS Regions considered harmful from one of the opera dev leads. Is that right, Chris? Did you?
Well, it's more than that. I don't know how to pronounce an A with a little circle on it. And I'm not very good at names, period. But it's Hakon William Lee or whatever, the father of CSS, so this current CTO of Opera. So, you know, has some gravitas here in all of the stuff that we talk about. Wrote this article for A List Apart, and I'm actually kind of interested in how the background of this goes on. Does he feel so strongly about this that he reached out to A List Apart because of their reach and said, here's something I want to publish on your site? Or did their editors go out and be like, hey, do you got anything you want to say right recently? Or, you know, cause like the origin of this article, I feel like, is almost just as important as what it says. But what it does say is, it says these CSS regions, which are these, we can talk about what they are, I guess, but they're harmful to see. He thinks that even though they're kind of coming and there's drafts for them and they're getting implemented in browsers, that this would be a kind of a wrong turn for CSS.
Yeah. So, I mean,
did you read it, Rachel?
I didn't. I've done a bit of sort of reading anyway, because I talk a bit about the sort of newer stuff that's happening in CSS. And yeah, so regions are a bit like your kind of desktop publishing flow thing, you know, where you create boxes and then you can flow text into the boxes. Right. They're not particularly web-like. But then having just published an ebook and used CSS to format that, there are other things that CSS and HTML are being used for other than the web. And I kind of wonder whether some of this stuff isn't really web-like, but that's because not everything that's consuming HTML and CSS is the web. And maybe it's to have these things out there. I guess there's always the argument that, well, if it's implemented in browsers, then people are going to misuse stuff. And yeah. but you know, sure. as we have for years, you know, with all sorts of things. But I'm not convinced.
You could really make a... Oh, right. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm not convinced this is should be just thrown out, you know, because it doesn't seem web-like and because it requires presentational elements and things. You know, it's I can see the issue. I can see what he's saying. And people have said it to me when I've talked about them as well. But yeah.
Sure. Because you can do some pretty gnarly stuff, right? You could make... For example, his problem number three is a text flow that's totally bizarre. So if you were to lay out a text like he did with little chunks all around that literally the browser is deciding, let's say it's, you know, 2,000 words of text that's just paragraph after paragraph of text. If you laid them out in this order, your eye would have no idea where to go. It would be weird, and you'd have to be kind of discovering it as you went. Actually, Scott McCloud covers this in the Understanding Comics a bit too, because comic artists kind of struggle with this commonly, I think, is when you lay out those square panels that make up a comic book page, you have to do it in such a way that it either doesn't matter or it's fairly obvious which panel kind of comes next in the flow of time. And you could quite easily screw that up, I think, with regions. But is that baby bathwater situation there, you know, like you can screw up color.
Yeah.
We should probably limit colors to the three accessible colors only. Black, white, and purple.
That's all you need.
Yeah, I think those are the only three colors, because if we do any more, it'll be harmful. I am not a fan of this. New technology is harmful. It's awful. It's going to be terrible for everything because somebody might misuse it. I'm just like, that's such the, like, it's, I don't know. It's just like, no one should make a hammer because somebody might use it for murder.
Right. There's some kind of.
It's like, well, actually, hammers proved to be very handy over the years, you know. But I guess if he's saying, if there's like a technical argument other than like a icky, like feels icky argument, and that's kind of what I've gotten.
Well, there's
from
an
it.
Accessibility it argument. Icky, there's right? like, here's all these disparate divs all over the page that are empty or have dummy content empty. In there, whatever.
Yeah.
But is a empty div an accessibility problem? Doesn't a most accessibility software and such kind of just skip over things ignore, that are empty.
Yeah.
And then that allows you then to have one div that is meaningful. It is marked up semantically appropriately. Mm. And it just kind of flows into these other ones that would feel empty. I thought it was an accessibility win when I was first learning about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are possibilities for it to be so. I mean, of course, you know, there's loads of ways you could be approaching building something using this stuff. But I mean, I think a lot of it does really come from the print world and the fact that people are wanting to use CSS to lay out print stuff. And then it's a whole different ballgame because that, you know, the fact that there's redundant divs, well, that doesn't matter. Once something's been, you know, turned into a PDF or printed or whatever. So, yeah.
This will be certainly discussed at great length. I know some of the people from Adobe are the people who are working on regions, and they have some people even in the comments of this article that are just saying like, hey, we're just going to prepare a rebuttal. So we'll link to this. And if they manage to get out that rebuttal by the time we publish this article, we'll link to that as well. Mm. So, okay, enough of that. How about the fact that Squarespace now has this tool in which that you can design a logo on? I don't know. How do you frame that, Dave? Frame that better than I just did.
So Squarespace made a thing called Squarespace Logo, and in their original text it said you can create a professional logo that is, you know, in minutes or whatever. And basically you type in your name and it'll choose icons from the Noun project, and that's your logo. And you can, it has a little like JavaScript kind of I don't know, like almost like a Photoshop that you can just drag around and resize your logo and change your text font face to one of six different font faces. It's actually super clever, right? Like the software, it's just like, here's a simple logo. I will make you a simple logo. Hmm. But I think the drama comes, is this killing our industry?
Things are always Rachel? Killing our industry, aren't they? I mean, they're not your customer. If someone is going to use a logo designing tool like that, they're not the customer of a professional logo designer, and they're never going to be, you know. It's like,
and if that logo turns out better than the one you did, you should probably level up your logo making.
I mean, I never understand why these things cause a drama. It's a bit, you know, it's like when there are sites that let you build a web, well, something like Squarespace, even, you know, can be used by people who aren't designers to put themselves together a website. And that's great, because I think the nice thing about the web is that it is accessible to people to create stuff and create content, and even though they're not developers. And it's actually become quite complicated these days. It's not like it was, you know, you could learn HTML in an afternoon and be building a website, and that's not really. You can't build a website that you're going to be happy with these days just by learning a bit of HTML. So we have tools for people to do that, and that's cool. You know, I think this is the same sort of thing.
I love that answer. That's how I feel about it too.
Well, so Squarespace, we should, full disclaimer, they have sponsored the show before. Mm-hmm. We think they're cool. But I think that, you know, I think it's because they made it that people are like up in arms, because Squarespace is already in danger of, we get this question all the time. Is
That's
Squarespace
a good point.
Kill web
if somebody
design,
just released you know? This as an independent thing, would people feel the same way about it?
Yeah. If I made this in a code pen, I'd probably get 1,000 likes, but
I would like it.
But if it's, you know, like, but because Squarespace did it, you know, I think like, you know, the Google web fonts plus Noun project idea is pretty sweet.
Hmm.
I'm trying to, I think it actually puts the 99 designs on notice. I mean, I'm sure, I think they're probably in trouble. 'Cause if it's, I think that's the market
yes.
it's stealing
yeah.
from.
Yeah, I think that's it's that very, very sort of, you know, people who would, yes, spend a few dollars on something. It's that market that's more in danger, not, you know, professional logo designers who do, you know, a really careful job for people and really get into their business and sort of their brand. Yeah, I never understand why these things cause a fuss. I mean, something like Squarespace, you might say, well, that's a competitor to my product because I have a CMS, but it's not because they're different. You know, it's completely different people are going to want those things, you know. So,
yeah, I think so. Like, I noticed Jessica Hish, who does logos and tie or in lettering, you know, that this sort of stuff. I think one of the things she took notice was their language, like that it's creating a professional logo, you know, rather than just saying like it. A simple logo, and they ended up changing it. I think that the language was like, this is a competitive to a whatever $1 million agency, and it's like not, you know, it's just
so they changed it. That's part of the drama, is that they did remove that language from the thing anyway. Yeah. So yeah. That's the completion of that drama. There's an article here at fontfeed.com, Google Web Fonts, The Spy Inside. So let's attempt to recap this one. And it kind of comes from WordPress. They had they updated to whatever 3.8, I guess it is now, and it's a major visual change to the back end of that site. And part of it is they use a web font called Open Sans, which everybody loves. Open Sans, great looking font, but they don't link it from. They don't like ship Open Sans with WordPress. They link to it from fonts.googleapis.com, where the domain that has the, you know, that serves Google Fonts. That's what they're for. They're for public linking to. And the concern being that when you request a resource from anywhere, from any third party, you're sending headers to that third party that contain general information about the browser and stuff that, right, like what your user agent is and stuff like that. So some people are like, that, you know, all of a sudden now I clicked one button in WordPress and now I'm sending information to Google that I wasn't before I clicked that button. So that's the concern that's a little understandable, but what's happening here is to frame it in such a way that is Google is spying on you is like it's they're not doing anything that they weren't doing before. I can understand the kind of like, oh, all of a sudden we're using a third party that maybe we weren't as like clear about us using before, but anytime you link to a third party resource anywhere for any reason, that this is what's going on. You're sending headers, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like Google Ajax library, probably just whatever, catching a little analytics on how many times that file's requested for your site or something. And maybe that's feeding into their traffic reports or something. Who knows, you know? But I don't know.
So let's say, Dave, you put an embedded code pen on your blog and then somebody visited your blog. They would load a script that we use to load the iframe and make the little embedded code pen on your site. And then it would be a little bit like them being mad at, I guess, code pen, or maybe you even, Dave, that there was a third party resource on that page and that their headers were then sent to that third party. So I could be in the middle of this drama. It's kind of the same scenario.
I mean, and it's possible, like, you know, that people are sending cookies or, you know, header data. I don't know what it could be. Maybe if you stash somebody's whatever cookie or session ID or something, maybe that sends. I don't really know, but maybe I should know or I'm going to get fired. But I think it's just sort of extreme, you know, but in this day and age of NSA and all that stuff, you know, maybe it is worth being kind of suspicious, you know?
I think these days people are sort of far more removed from the nuts and bolts of how the web works and how these things work. And it's a bit like the sort of whole cookie thing in the UK where, yeah, we ended up having to put these ridiculous cookie notices on web pages, which they then decided we didn't need to put on web pages. But a lot of that is because people don't really understand. They don't understand what a cookie is. They don't understand what a third-party resource is. Or, you know, it's like, and even people who work on the web are sometimes fairly unclear as to what's going on. Because we're not, you know, we're not sort of exposed to the real nuts and bolts of it anymore, as I think we used to be. And I think that just sort of frightens people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why we hear more of this sort of thing, as well as and the fact that people are very worried about people spying on them and collecting data, and what they're doing with that.
Thanks for a juicy headline, that's for sure.
Mm.
So well, let's say you
gets
need
you some blog traffic.
we have some good questions for Rachel that I want to get to. So let's do a sponsor real quick to kind of segue into that. We have Media Temple as our sponsor, and they provide hosting, right? They have their grid service, which you can put like 100 different sites on, and Shirley hosts PHP, and surely there's loads of perch sites on Media Temple, I'm sure. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, yeah. We see them.
Yeah.
And cool. I don't see any problems from them either, so...
Yeah, how's that for
you? You're on your good list. There we go.
I use it too. CSS Tricks is on Media Temple. It's on a DV plan, which is kind of their dedicated virtual thing. And it's been actually really awesome for me for a long time. So I'm happy that they're a sponsor for us. So it's all managed. You get your kind of a custom control panel on the Media Temple side if you want to control some stuff. And then if you get the DV like I have, you get Plesk on the back end too to kind of control your whole server and install whatever you want on it and do that stuff. One of the best things that I like about Media Temple is that they are always super responsive to support requests, and no matter who you are, if you at Media Temple Help on Twitter, they're like on the ball. I've never seen a company be as like on the ball of support on Twitter as Media Temple is. And then you kind of just send them the number of your support request, and you'll get served faster than if you just were to go in there and just wait. You know, just kind of bug them online, and then they know you're worth helping first for whatever reason. So hot tip there to use 25% off your first month if you use coupon code SHOPTALK at Media Temple. So fan of them. Good work. Thanks for sponsoring the show. Let's talk about Perch a little bit more, because we have a question from Pierre L. Dave?
Pierre L. writes in, first off, I'm a fan of Perch, and I've been using it for some time. One thing that's not very well known is that Perch actually pre-renders its PHP into static pages, so it doesn't suffer from performance hits from MySQL when visitors hit the site. For example, if you edit a news story in the CMS, when the admin saves the story, and it adds your post as HTML to a static PHP page, it doesn't fetch the post every time somebody visits the website. I was wondering if Rachel could explain how that compares to static site generators like Jekyll, which we talk about a lot on this show. Is the performance similar to flat files generated by Jekyll? Any advantages, disadvantages versus static site generators? Rachel?
Right. Okay. So what we actually do is we essentially cache the sort of the template. So basically you have templates which are how your stuff is marked up, and then you have obviously your content that you're adding in the CMS, so yeah, you the actual content that the content editor is putting in. And then when that's saved, what we do is we compile that together. So there is a request to MySQL and when a page loads, but it's usually just one, you might have a few regions, you might have two or three, but we keep that fairly light, so we're not quite generating out to just a flat HTML file like some of the static site generators are, but we're doing as sort of as few requests via MySQL as we possibly can. So the sites do tend to render very, very quickly, and that's something we just care about an awful lot, is the performance. Why it's different is because we are using a database, and a lot of these static site generators and the sort of the flat file CMSs, what they're essentially doing is they're creating a database using PHP, using code. They're creating a flat file database. And all those problems, there's an awful lot of problems inherent in that, you know, in terms of, well, what happens if you've got two people who want to edit the file at once? And also doing the sort of processing that you need to do on data to filter it and sort it and so on, doing that in PHP isn't very efficient. It's far more efficient to do that in MySQL. It's been designed to do that, which is why we use a database. And so that we kind of try and have a bit of best of both worlds, I guess. You know, we have the speed of being able to sort of cache stuff and sort of flatten it down to only needing to do one request. But if people want to do more stuff, if they want to filter it and sort it and so on, they can do, because they've got the power of a database behind it. So I guess that's the difference.
Sure. And there, I mean, there's a UI to Perch, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, right. We've got an admin interface. We're not sort of this kind of inline editor type things that also you see. We actually have, we have an admin UI.
Sometimes we mention that in regards to Jekyll is that like that's a little bit too possibly too nerdy of a thing to hand off to a client, whereas Perch is kind of almost built to hand off to a client, right?
Yeah, that's one of our big things is making it very, very simple for clients to edit stuff, because if they've got quite a simple site, they don't want to have to wade through masses of stuff to edit it, you know. So yeah.
And I think that's probably the difference with major difference between a static site generator. It's like if you hand a client a static site generator, I hope they know how to use YAML front matter really well, you know, or something like that, you know. I know how to do that, and I'll painstakingly write, 800 lines of YAML or some PHP array that's god awful just because I'm bored and I want to do it simple. But yeah, like for a client, that's you gotta have a database, man. In my opinion, for most clients, I don't know.
That's the moral of the story here, right? Don't fear the DB.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, now isn't that Perch's strength? Like, wasn't that when you started Perch? It seems like it was when it hit the market. It was like this kind of granular content management. Am I saying that right?
Yeah,
describing it right?
Yeah, I mean, we try not to ever mess with anyone's markups. You can write whatever you want. You know, you control the markup completely. We don't really ever insert any markup. That's all in your templates. So that's kind of important to us because we're, sort of dyed-in-the-wool web standards people. So we wanted to make sure that people had control over their markup. So that's kind of important to us, and the fact that people can create content templates rather than giving people a big text area with a WYSIWYG editor on and saying go on, style it up the way you like, you know, because that doesn't work with clients either.
It has structured data and no opinions on template.
Yeah, we don't, I mean, you know, we let people use WYSIWYG editors if that's what they want to do. They can use them as plugins, but by default, we've just moved to Markdown. We used to be Textile by default. We're now using Markdown by default.
That's an interesting thing to talk about, I think. Do you save it to the DB as Markdown, or do you transfer it to HTML and save that? What if you're caught in between those worlds of some of your content is in HTML and some of it isn't?
Yeah, I mean, generally what happens is people will work on one or the other. My preference when we were doing client work was always we tended to work in textile, so would be that no HTML is ever entered anywhere by a client because they make a mess, you know. So we'd give them textile, and then we'd convert that obviously into HTML and store both because you need to be able to re-edit it. So that's really the approach we've used for Perch, although if you want to use a WYSIWYG editor and insert HTML, then you're very welcome to, because you can do that. But, you know, we try and guide people down the sort of Markdown or textile route just because it saves an awful lot of trouble with those clients who know a bit of HTML.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to go. If I could go kind of back in time on some of that stuff, I would start with Markdown and make sure it's getting saved to the DB as Markdown. So it makes the editing experience nicer. For example, my blog just happens to be on WordPress and I like it. I've used it forever. I have a Markdown plugin I use on some WordPress sites. And that's nice because I prefer that if I can write in Markdown. But because it's a plugin, it's not like in the core of that CMS. It can't really save to the database as Markdown just because if that plugin were to be deactivated, it would ruin all your content. So because it has to save to the database as HTML, that means it has to like convert back into Markdown before you edit it. When the problem with that is that that's kind of fine, but what's weird about that is like you hit save on something, and let's say you used like dashes or something because that's how you like to mark up your list, it'll convert them to stars with more spaces than you put after it, because that conversion back process just does it in one standardized way. And so it's not exactly what you were just saving, you know, and I hate that it doesn't show me exactly what I wrote. Yeah. Anyway. That's my thing. And it's nice that it's core in Perch. That makes me want to use
it. Because we'd done this with our big framework that we were developing stuff for clients, we kind of knew it worked. And we knew that actually clients accepted using things like Textile and Markdown actually very well once it was explained to them. And that in combination with structured content templates. So people aren't having to sort of style all their text, really. They're really using it for making things strong and adding some links and things. That's about all they're doing, really. They get on quite well with it.
Good to know, people. Get your clients on Markdown. All right, we got one from Morgan Steele. It's an audio one.
An audio question, our favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show. Morgan Steele. That's a power name if I've ever heard one. Here we go.
Hey, guys. Love the show. This is Morgan from Raleigh, North Carolina. I was wondering if you had some suggestions or best practices for creating a website search. Some small to medium-sized websites I've worked on don't really necessitate a CMS for various reasons, but a search option would be great. I typically use Google's customized search tools, but didn't know if I was missing the boat on something else. Any ideas or discussions would be great.
So search, okay. How do you integrate search into a site? Morgan has a site that isn't in a CMS at all, which how do you do search for that? And then what say he was using a CMS? Is he kind of just assuming that a CMS automatically helps with that? For example, does Perch help you with search?
Yeah, we've got search. Search is actually quite difficult to implement as anything else. I mean, we've used things like Apache Solr on mm-hmm. bigger things. It's actually what we use for our documentation, which lets you do sort of real proper search. Search in a lot of CMSs, it's difficult because you often don't really know where the content's coming from and what shape it is. And we've actually recently done quite a bit of work on the Perch search to try and improve it, because we don't actually know a lot about people's sites, because they can sort of add Perch to pages that they've created. We don't necessarily know exactly what that content is. So then to try and display it is quite difficult because they could have any kind of template, you know. So searches, even within unless you're something like WordPress, where you know everything's a blog post, and so that's quite straightforward to search. The more you allow people to use structured content, the harder it gets to search, basically, because it's all broken down. So I think ultimately things like Solr are probably the best way to go if you want really good search. That's sure. then installing.
And you don't want to use something like Google, right? You can make a Google custom search engine. It takes about 2 seconds and it will return pretty darn good results for you. The problem is they either have ads on them or it's not free.
I think if you really have just got a static site, that's probably the way to go, because you're probably not in that situation thinking about, you know, rolling out something like Solr or whatever. I think if you want really good search, that's probably the way to go. I think there are things like Solr as a service, you know, that people are offering, which might be something to look at.
Yeah, I can't think of any, but there is. We use Solr in combination with various stuff on CodePen, because we have to you have to maintain your own index and stuff. It was like a absolutely not trivial project to integrate into the – yeah.
But it is very cool.
It is cool, and it's kind of set it and forget it. Once you get it done and it's indexing properly, it runs really well. It's not something that you have to babysit. I don't know if you found that to be the case.
Yeah, it is very good. And you know, you can do all sorts of stuff other than searching, really. You know, you can use it to actually pull back all sorts of bits of data to display bits of your site and things. So it's pretty cool. It's not a trivial thing to set up. And if you've only got a static site, it's probably quite a small site.
Sure. Good luck, Morgan. Good question. Plenty of different ways to do it. Some CMSs offer it. Otherwise, you can use a third-party thing, or you can hardcore nerd out and use Solr. We have...
Just use Solr. It's make it sound that easy. That's good. Just use Solr. Just put it on it. Yeah. You got it.
Artifact Conf is coming back to Austin, Texas. Is this their second round in Austin? Because they did the first one. What is that?
This is lap number two.
Yeah.
So it went Austin, now to Providence. Now it's come back to Austin.
May 5th through 7th at the Alamo Draft House Ritz. It's going to be a good old time. It's the hometown of the whole Paravel crew, including Dave Rupert.
Hey, I'm here.
But it's an in-person conference, and it's like specific, you know, as a lot of conferences these days are kind of, they end up talking a lot about responsive design because it's such a big topic and stuff. But this is specifically about that, right? Like the talks are, it's about this multi-device world. So if you're into that, as you should be, because it's huge, you know, sea change in our industry, that's going to be the overall theme through this whole thing. Jeremy Keith speaking at it. Josh Clark's doing the closing keynote. People you'll recognize from Shop Talk Show. Brad Frost, Valhead. Lots of cool people here, and I'm sure I will troll this list to find more guests for our show as well. So go to artifactconf.com to find out about it. Go hang out with Dave in Austin. It's going to be amazing, I'm sure. You had a good time at it last time, I'm sure, right?
It's so nice, and it's got like a designery kind of edge to it, you know. So if you or your company or whatever are having trouble like making the organizational shift even over to responsive design, this is pretty awesome for that. So check it out. That's all I got to say.
Okay.
Shall we move on? We got another audio question from the...
should we do this?
A long time listener. Oh, go. You got
I think we skipped the very first one, didn't we? Because that has to do with Perch 2. And I think that. I have a question. I'm going to say Alan Nemec writes in, I had a question for Rachel Andrew. I'm not sure if your customers share this information with you, but I was wondering what ratio of newcomers to Perch CMS are new to CMSs in general, or if they're migrating from another CMS. And for those migrating, is there a particular CMS that tends to be the most common one that they're coming from? He goes on, but I think we could leave it at that for now.
Okay, yeah, we have, it's a real mix, actually. We do have a fair number of people who let us know that using Perch has been the first time that they've been able to offer a CMS to their clients, which is really nice. It's nice to be able to kind of make that difference to someone's business, that this is a new thing they can do. We get quite a lot of people who are Expression Engine users. Yeah. Not so much migrating.
That's what Al says he was.
Yeah, they're not so much migrating from always Expression Engine, but they're using Perch for the projects that are, you know, maybe don't need as much stuff doing. I mean, increasingly, I think we're nibbling into that space because Perch has become an awful lot more sort of fully featured and better for larger sites since we went to Perch 2. So I think possibly we've got more of those people now. There are other things on the market as well that Expression Engine users are going to. And we get a lot of WordPress people. I mean, we've got an importer to our blog from WordPress, and so we get quite a lot of WordPress users who are migrating over.
Oh, nice. So there's a tool for that, which I'm sure was a business choice, right? It is just kind of a huge CMS, so you might as well.
Well, I mean, partly it was because I wanted to move my blog, and I had like 10 years of blog posts, which had gone from movable type into WordPress originally, and then I wanted to move on to Perch, and I had to move them. So we wrote the tool so I could move my blog, and then we had the tool. So we sort of published it for people.
Nice.
We also did one for
forums that have done that.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of cool. It says something about the web and our industry that we can move from like drastically different software largely because database, because, you know, it's just structured data of one kind, and it can be, you know, with sufficient nerdery can be moved.
Yeah. So it's a bit of everything really.
Cool. Do you want to move to the next one, Dave?
Yeah, the audio one?
Sure, yeah.
Does that sound good? All right, here we go from Poop Splat, Matt Soria.
Hey, guys. Poop Splat here. Got a question for you both about your processes when building a site for a CMS or a template framework or something like that. So do you find it easier to start out coding in static HTML files, or do you start it off right away coding into the partials or templates or whatever it is that it's going to end up being in the end? I've spent a lot of time building for WordPress and found it easier to start the coding process in static HTML first, so I'm free to focus on writing solid HTML and CSS and then worry about chopping it up into partials and includes and whatnot later, keeping those as separate tasks, you know? And I'm starting a redesign, and I'm building with Statamic, which is, I think, fairly newer. And it's a really simple template structure. So I'm wondering if I shouldn't just start coding right away into the framework, and if starting out with that, you know, HTML, static HTML is a waste of time since it's simple enough anyway. Any insights into your processes? Especially, Chris, I know that you do a lot with WordPress. So anything you could share would be really helpful. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Overall, the question is kind of like, I know if you've already picked a CMS, is it better to just like dig into how that CMS does things and work that way? Or do you kind of keep yourself CMS agnostic as you start and then maybe later pick a CMS and then move those templates into that CMS? Do you have an opinion about that kind of thing, Rachel?
Yeah, I mean, when we were building stuff for clients, I tended to just start by building the templates as HTML and CSS, just because it was kind of easier to then play around with them, make sure that everybody was happy with them, and then add them to the CMS. I mean, the way that Perch tends to work is that you can build a site and then you can make it editable, because that's the way around that we do Perch. For bigger sort of CMSs, you're going to end up with some kind of sort of MVC like front controller setup, so you're going to have things more split up. And then, yes, it's probably easier to build templates and then make it into the CMS thing. I think otherwise you're sort of running the risk of, if you're designing and developing, you're running that sort of risk of building for the CMS and building things, sort of modifying a template almost, rather than building something that's right for that site and then working out how to make it manageable. So I think that's, you know, when you see sites that all look the same because they're all built on WordPress or some e-commerce thing or whatever, I think a lot of that is because people have started modifying a template rather than saying, this is what I want and how do I now make it content manageable?
Sure. That makes sense. I would think in general, if you're trying to make this choice, that kind of starting with just however you would do it outside of a CMS is probably a more honest way to go about it then. You know, you're more true to the site and your vision and the goals and the whatever. But I can see how that it might be a little slower too, you know, but I don't know. Well, I did a course for lynda.com way back on this subject, and it happened to be WordPress, you know, but the way that I approached it was kind of like, let's design something in Photoshop and then let's break it apart, not even thinking about the CMS at all. As the middle step, you know, make it HTML, CSS, and then the last step we'll move it into the CMS. So I've kind of advocated that way in the past. And I think you lose that ability a little bit over time. And now, for example, working on a site like CSS Tricks that's so big and there's so many templates and there's so much structured data that's so different. I don't think I could go back and start without it. Like moving CMSs would be a tremendously large project for that. But that's okay. You know, it doesn't mean that I'm stuck on that CMS forever for every other thing that I do for the rest of my life. It just means that site is the hooks are in a little too deep to get out of it. Even though I don't really care. I like it. It works for me. It doesn't mean that. Anyway, what do you think, Dave?
So the partial thing, I just did a site yesterday and it's going to go into WordPress. I know it's going to head that way. We just started with these like kind of like fake WordPressy templates. Like I have an underscore header.php, underscore footer.php, because I know that's what it's going to be named. Yeah. And I just do includes. I don't do the get header thing. And you know, if I need to do a list of posts, maybe I'll like take some JSON, you know, and spit that out or something like that, using some very simple PHP. Because that for me, it just like Matt's saying, it keeps it kind of clear from the implementation. And you know, you'd never know, like could be last minute thing. Some guy's like, hey, have you heard about Cool Guy CMS? We really need to do that, and he's the boss, so then you have to do that. So. I don't know. I think it'd probably be nice to have those like HTML, CSS versions in your pocket.
I agree.
Right?
Yep.
That's all. And that's what I'm doing. So if it's wrong, I don't want to be right. Awesome.
Nico So, dang it. Solahin.
Solahin. Got it.
Very simple question. Any must-read books for people who are thinking of starting up a small web shop / agency? Are there any books to recommend in that businessy perspective?
Probably the person whose stuff to look at would be Brennan Dunn, who's he writes a lot about freelancing, and I think he's, let's have a look.
There's the classic design as a job that
BrennanDunn.com. And he writes a lot about freelancing and, you know, how to set decent rates and things like that. And so he certainly does an awful lot of that sort of stuff, and he'd be a good person to sort of listen to some of his podcasts and read some of his stuff, I think.
Yeah. BrennanDunn.
BrennanDunn.com.
Nice. Simple answer, simple question. Dave Williams has got a question here too.
Dave Williams, I'm a self-taught freelance web designer. I've been working for a few years now and I'm thinking about taking on a new member of staff. My question is, how do I go about making websites from a local computer and start making websites as a team? I have fairly standard MAMP, CodeKit, Sublime Text set up and was wondering how to scale this up. Should I be thinking about buying another cheap computer and using that as a local testing server rather than MAMP? Help me out.
So Dave's in this confusing spot where he works on websites all by himself on one computer and now wants to be more collaborative and work on projects with multiple people. You know, presumably you guys do that when you work on Perch and multiple people work on it. How do you keep everybody in sync? What's the strategy there?
Well, I think the important thing is source control, which is probably Git these days. You know, once you've got things checked into source control, then you can have two people work on it and you can check things out and check them back in. And it should solve the sort of problems where two people work on the same thing. It will most of the time solve that problem. I mean, having some sort of staging server, I mean, if you're working in the same office, then that could be a box in the office, a computer in the office that you're staging stuff on, or having just, I mean, these cheap VMs are great for using as a staging server, you know, so you can upload changes there and say, we tend to say, right, that's the master copy of the database is the one that's on the staging server. So if I'm starting working on something, I'll grab that copy of the database and I'll check out the latest version of the source and then I'll work on it. And I'll make sure that my changes are committed back. I think it's just planning workflows really, and just so everyone knows what best to do. But source control is the thing really.
Yeah, and that's what Dave didn't mention here, and I feel like that's leading him down the right path. Maybe Dave isn't even aware of that, but definitely look up. You might just go straight to GitHub.com just because it's such a nice kind of onboarding experience, if you will, and they have some tutorials there to kind of walk you through getting your first repo set up. So maybe instead of buying a book just on Git, maybe just go right to GitHub, it's their business to help you solve this problem. So. And they're pretty universally loved, I feel like, so you can't really go wrong with GitHub.
Yeah, we quite like Beanstalk app as well. They've got quite nice tutorials for sort of people getting started with source control.
I was going to say that's the one piece of software he doesn't mention, like. He's using MAMP, CodeKit, Sublime. MAMP and CodeKit are pretty visual, like. If that's your thing, if you're not a command line wizard, get the GitHub app. It's really nice. Or Tower is nice, and you can use it with Beanstalk. It's $25 for your organization or $7 for your personal account to like start using, having private repositories. So, it's worth it.
Yeah.
It's worth that money.
Yep.
All right. Let's finish it up with one quick little one, just Noah Bass is curious about WebP. He basically says, if you have a big image carousel with lots of images on it, possibly something you could do with structured data in Perch, am I right? Do you think, do you ever think about implementing the WebP image format in your site? Is it just not worth the time at this point? Have you guys looked at WebP at all?
No, I haven't really looked at it, only in that I kind of know it exists. it's not really something I've looked into, I'm afraid. Have heard of it, but that's about it.
The tooling isn't there for it, I think. You know, like if Photoshop can't save out as it, then how do you even get it, you know? And I've looked into it enough to know that you need some kind of like command line tool to build it for you. There's a grunt thing, which that's probably how I would figure out about it. Or that I would get involved at first. Somebody did send me, you know, there's like a little like SVG trick, and I don't know, it probably works for anything, where you like attach an error handler on the image. So you're like source equals whatever.svg, but on error, flop out the source to whatever.png. That works for WebP too. So if somebody really wanted to just play with it in a really limited context, you could give that a shot. The question is, how do you even make WebP documents at all? And that's like, I don't even know.
You can't.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, you have to make a JPG first and then run it through the command line. I think what the pros do, this is me speaking as not a professional, they do it all server side. So you use something like Google PageSpeed, which is like a module that sits on your Apache or your Nginx, and it'll just basically say, oh, you're using Chrome and you allow WebP? Let me serve you the WebP faster. I'll generate one and serve it to you in cache.
Wow. So, really? That's amazing.
I think that's my next kind of... I've installed PageSpeed on the server, mod PageSpeed before, but then like it uses an insane amount of memory. So every time somebody went to my website, it crashed the whole server, client sites and all. So I am very scared of it, but I think that's my next thing is figure out mod PageSpeed.
Save the server guy.
There's an art. Yeah, pretty much. I'm like, hi, I'm the web server guy. I fix servers and build websites. And but what was I going to say? Oh, there was an article on, if you guys read the Perf Planet, speaking of 24 ways, it's like an advent calendar for web performance, Perf Planet. Somebody
wrote about mod page speed, is what you're saying?
Well, so breaking the page speed barrier with Bootstrap, okay, is the name of the article. And this guy wrote this article about how he just kind of like started tuning his server and stuff like that. And then somebody, I think it's probably Ilya Grigorovic, is like, well, here's a mod page speed configuration that brings you to 100 out of 100 on page speed. Yeah. Like basically you like use core filters, prioritize critical CSS, defer your JavaScript, sprite all your images, convert PNG to JPG, convert JPG to WebPG, or WebPG, collapse white space, remove comments, bam.
I do want you to learn how to do this. You can tell me.
Oh, man. I mean, he's taking a Bootstrap, right? So you guys are all nerds. So Bootstrap off the shelf has a mobile score of 77, desktop score of 90, DOM content loaded 833 milliseconds. You just drop that in, that mod page speed variable, and like you are cooking. He basically gets it down to mobile score 100, desktop score 100, DOM content loaded 151 milliseconds. Wow,
it's like 7x better ish.
Dude, sick.
Sick.
I get nosebleeds about page speed. That's pretty. I just think about it all night long. I'm like, oh, how fast could that be? I would love to have it so fast. Anyway.
All right. Weirdo.
On that note, on that bombshell, Rachel, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show. On behalf of everybody, I think we want to say thank you, and thank you for all the like thoughts and stuff you inject into our community. Really appreciate that. So what is one thing that you want to plug, and then how can people find you and give you money? How does that work?
Well, I've got a new book out, which I've self-published, which is a new venture for me. And it's called The Profitable Side Project Handbook. And it's all about really creating side projects that actually earn you some money. And you can find out about that on my website, rachelandrews.co.uk.
This is this ebook format?
It's ebook format, yeah.
Or
yeah. So I also write on the site about all the trials and tribulations of actually converting my documents to ebook format, if anyone's interested in that, which was quite painful. So, so yeah.
Yikes. This is awesome. I might actually pick it up here.
It's too bad that it is so painful. Expense. I want to write a book like that too, but last time I did it, we just did PDF only, just out of fear of all this stuff. But you kind of have to, right? Because you reach a larger audience.
Yeah. Once you've got it all worked out, it's not so bad, but it took some working out. So I wrote it all up in case that's helpful to anybody else. So,
surely will be. All right. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Last words, Dave.
Oh, I was just going to say thank everyone for coming out in the chat room. We really appreciate it. Thank everyone for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. We made it to 100 episodes, guys. Round of applause for yourself. Thanks for sticking with us. We really appreciate it. And get excited for episode 1, 2, 3 in the future.
ChopDocShow.com.